Shrink Wrap Radio number 887, Dr. Heather Sanderson on improving brain health.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dr. Heather Sanderson, a renowned naturopathic doctor specializing in neurocognitive medicine and the founder of SoulSer Health Clinic in San Diego. We're going to be discussing her pioneering work and her forthcoming book, Reversing Alzheimer's, the new toolkit to improve cognition and protect brain health. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Heather Sanderson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's a privilege to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's good to have you. And congratulations on your forthcoming book, Alzheimer's, the New Toolkit to Improve Cognition and Protect Brain Health. We're going to be discussing that and your work more generally. But first, I'd like to get a bit more about your background. I see that you're a naturopath. For our audience, what is that? And how did it come to pass in your life?
Yeah, so I'm a naturopathic doctor. I was trained at a place called Bastyr University up in Seattle. And I went to San Francisco State, actually, up in your neck of the woods in the Bay Area. And I, with the intention of going to UCSF, to going into conventional medicine and becoming a medical doctor. And then I had some of my own health issues come up while I was an undergrad. And I went to see many medical doctors, and I didn't get a lot of support. I had some issues with my jaw, a TMJ disorder, and I went and saw, you know, anyone who would see me, the psychiatrist and the acupuncturist and the medical doctors, and I went to Kaiser and I went to my school, and I was just kind of running in circles, not getting any help. Until I found an osteopath, actually, who helped a ton. I was essentially 80% better in about an hour. Wow. And in that meeting with her, she suggested that I should look into naturopathic medicine. And through that, I discovered that there were other people thinking about medicine the same way I was. That instead of just bringing drugs, medications, and surgeries as a toolkit, it was about more than that. It was really about understanding health and what it meant for the cells to be healthy. And naturopathic medicine was also about becoming a teacher, docere, or doctor as teacher, looking for the root causes of disease. Mm-hmm. And those things excited me much more than the algorithms around determining a diagnosis and then the right drug or medication to treat the disease process.
Yeah, I can understand that. And I've talked to others of that persuasion as well. So how did you come to be interested in the brain?
Yeah. So in 2017, I was at a meeting, the Integrative Mental Health Symposium, and Dr. Dale Bredesen was speaking. And he was talking about Alzheimer's. He was about to publish his book, The End of Alzheimer's. And for the first time in my professional life, in my life, I was hearing from someone that you could reverse Alzheimer's and dementia. And I was a complete skeptic. But I was so intrigued because the way he was describing going about it made sense to me. He was basically suggesting that if we stacked our interventions, diet plus exercise plus nutrients plus getting rid of toxins, plus getting adequate sleep, that we could actually see improvement in cognition, even in people with Alzheimer's disease. And this, I had been told, I remember being in a neurology class and being told that there was nothing we could do for dementia, that to suggest that we could help someone in that position would be to do harm, would be to give them false hope. And so Dr. Wow. Bredesen had very, you know, conflicting argument that no, that you could do something. And in fact, as he described it, it was almost overwhelming how much you could do to support brain health. And it was also kind of common sense, just uncommon practice. So I was intrigued enough that I signed up for a more robust course with him. And then I was on his list of doctors who had been trained right as his book was coming out. And my first patient, Darlene, came into my office and she had a MoCA score of 2. So the Montreal Cognitive Assessment is, we shorten that to MoCA score, and it's on a scale of 30. Some people may have seen this. You draw a clock, you copy a box, you identify zoo animals, identify where you are in time and space, yeah. and you get a score out of 30. 30 is perfect. Normal is 26 and above. And she had a score of 2. At this point, I did not have a lot of confidence. She was one of my very first patients that I had ever been seen after training. And she was very progressed. She had severe dementia. She was answering questions with yes or no. I could see, you know, she had this bright, beautiful smile, and I could see the wheels turning in her brain. But by the time she went to answer a question, she couldn't even remember the question. And of course, her experience with her husband, her life was severely affected. She was completely dependent on him. And although you could see her soul shining through, so much of her had been lost. And I sort of unenthusiastically guided them through what to do, but didn't expect her to get any better. And 6 weeks later, she came back and she was significantly better. Her MoCA score had gone from a 2 to a 7. So we could measure.
Yeah, certainly, you know, I'm familiar that the word on the street is that Alzheimer's can't be reversed, can't be cured, and that there's still so much that we need to understand about it. So I may be just a little bit skeptical of what you're saying, but I'm willing to entertain it and certainly interested in what your experience has been.
And David, I would yeah. clarify that I also don't believe that there's a cure for Alzheimer's.
Okay.
I have not seen someone cure it. However, there is a way to reverse it. And although, so this patient, Darlene, she went from a 2 to a 7. Now, her life wasn't perfect, but her quality of life and that of her husband's had changed dramatically. She
now,
could say,
what's the difference between cure and reverse?
Yeah, great question. So I think of a cure as, for example, if you have a breast cancer that's isolated to the breast and you go in and you cut it out, you have surgically cured breast cancer, right? It is now gone. There's nothing else that you maybe need to do. You might have a little higher risk of having a second breast cancer later on, but more or less, if you've taken out an early stage breast cancer that's isolated, you have cured it. If you have a urinary tract infection and you take a course of antibiotics, you don't have to do anything 2 weeks later. Once you've finished that course of antibiotics, it is cured. With Alzheimer's, what we see is that you need to maintain a lifestyle. You need to maintain certain interventions long-term to maintain the reversal of the disease process. That once that's started, if you have these genetic predispositions, it becomes kind of an Achilles heel. Your brain is likely to go backwards if you aren't good about getting exercise, sleep, making the dietary changes and maintaining them. If you're not good about taking the nutrients that are required to maintain brain function, then you can see people slip backwards. And so it's not a one and done, take this drug and you're free and clear. You yeah. really need to maintain a healthy lifestyle for your brain.
Yeah. Actually, I lost a good friend to Alzheimer's. So that, you know, that I have that experience in my background, and I know other people who have been given that diagnosis, either dementia or Alzheimer's, or it sounds like they don't know for sure. I think often they're not told for sure, you know, what they have. Right. I'm not sure that it can be accurately diagnosed short of a autopsy.
Actually, there are new tests that can be done that absolutely can diagnose Alzheimer's earlier. So there are blood tests that are available through LabCorp or Quest, including beta amyloid ratios and tau proteins. And then we can also do imaging that looks at amyloid in the brain. So dementia is the umbrella term. And then underneath dementia, Alzheimer's is the most common form of dementia. But we also have Lewy body dementia, vascular dementia, frontotemporal dementia. There are other types of dementia that people can have. And Alzheimer's is essentially associated with this change in the folding of the proteins, this abnormal change in proteins, including tau proteins and beta amyloid. And that is what characterizes Alzheimer's specifically.
Well, I think I heard that there might be a test, and I'll have to look into that more deeply, I think. So let's step through some of the main things about the lifestyle that you teach and talk about and promote. And so one is, you talk about a diet that boosts gut health by tapping into the gut-brain connection. And we hear a lot about the gut. That's been the focus of some of my interviews with doctors who were of that, alternative doctors, I would say, who were strongly of that persuasion. What's your experience around that?
Yeah, so I ascribe to this idea that health starts in the gut, and the gut starts in the mouth. And so we need to be taking care of this organ and really prioritizing our gut health, because we literally are what we eat. Essentially, we are glorified donuts, right? We've got this hole in the middle. And if we don't care for that hole in the middle, we're not going to be able to absorb the building blocks that become our neurotransmitters, that become the cells of our brain, but the cells of our heart, the cells of our bones, the cells everywhere in our body. And if we have poor nutrition, if it's either toxic, if it's, you know, too much blood sugar and not enough of the nutrients that are required, not enough of the good fats, we're not going to have adequate building blocks, right? We can't build a house without nails. So if we have this one piece missing, we're going to have chinks in the armor of our cellular processes. And even the armor of our cellular walls. And so much interaction happens on the cell membrane. And if we don't have good, high quality fats, proteins, nutrients, then that cell communication becomes dysfunctional. And that can lead to much of the breakdown associated with Alzheimer's. You mentioned the gut-brain connection, and so much of that has to do also with the microbes in our gut. So I think of digestion happening in four stages. First, we have to choose the right foods for us. And I am an advocate of a high quality organic ketogenic diet. This is high in protein, high in good quality fats that are anti-inflammatory, and so protein, fats, and veggies, non-starchy veggies, keeping our carbohydrates to a minimum so that we can get into ketosis. So number one is choosing the right foods to put into our mouth. And really, you know, I know you're in the world of psychology, and so I also could apply this to, you know, anything that we allow in, the relationships and the media, anything that we allow in. We want to choose stuff that's good for us. Then the second component of digestion is breaking it down. Can we break these pieces down into parts that we can then assimilate? That's the third process, part of the process. So in that breakdown, in that digestion phase, we use good, healthy gut microbes to do that. We need them in order to be able to break down the food that we eat. And so if we have an imbalance in our microbiome, too many of the bad guys, not enough of the good guys, we don't digest and then assimilate as well as we might otherwise. So eating foods that are high in, that are fermented, that are high in those good microbiome bugs, things like kimchi, sauerkraut, maybe some kefir, kombuchas that are low in sugar, Miso, there's a whole host of these things, and most indigenous cultures have a type of fermented vegetable or fermented food that's part of their traditional diet. Eating those regularly is a great way to help support a healthy microbiome. Getting plenty of fiber. These are our prebiotics. These are the things that help that healthy microbiome flourish. That also helps. And then reducing those carbohydrates, again, especially the highly processed carbohydrates, high levels of sugar, that will feed those bad bu gut bugs, the yeast and the other bugs that are going to make it harder to digest and assimilate our food.
Yeah, you really have to work hard these days to avoid processed foods that have a ton of things in it that you don't even know everything that's in them. And
Right.
is this the diet that's also referred to as the caveman diet?
So like a paleo diet or well, I don't know enough about the caveman diet specifically to say, but certainly this is an invitation to go back in the direction of a diet that your ancestors would have enjoyed. So less processed food, much less processed food, really with the goal of eliminating processed food entirely. Our bodies are designed to eat the food that comes from trees and comes straight from the ground, straight from the animal.
Yeah,
Not that.
even 100 years ago, I recently heard emphasized our diets were considerably different
Right.
because mostly they were natural foods coming out of the ground, and that's just that's what food was, and now it's become so very transmogrified. Now, you mentioned ketosis. What is ketosis?
Yeah, so ketosis is the state of burning fat or ketones for fuel instead of sugar or carbohydrates. And so when we restrict our carbohydrates, sugar, glucose, those are kind of interchangeable. When we restrict our carbohydrates to about 30 to 50 grams per day, and we want those would need to be spread out. If you have 30 grams of sugar all at once, you will raise your blood sugar. But if we can restrict our carbohydrates throughout the day to 30 to 50 and increase our fats, our good non-starchy veggies, our protein, then what we do is we flip a metabolic switch. And we go from burning from glycolysis, burning sugar for fuel, into ketosis, burning fat for fuel. And that is it, where our bodies are almost like hybrid engines. We can go back and forth between these. And it's sort of miraculous because if we don't have enough of one fuel source, we can use another. We won't starve. We won't die. We're not entirely dependent on glucose. Sometimes it feels like it, especially when we're addicted to sugar. But
Yeah.
we don't need to be entirely reliant on glucose. We can switch to ketosis. And our brain, when in the kind of research situations where they've given the brain both glucose and ketones at the same time, the brain prefers to burn ketones. We create less oxidative stress when we're burning ketones, and we tend to feel sharper, more mentally clear, and we don't have those sugar drops and spikes. Additionally, as we age, regardless of our diabetes status, we all become more insulin resistant and less sensitive to glucose, especially in our brain. We don't burn that as efficiently. We aren't as good as turning sugar into fuel as we age as we are at using ketones. And so many people will have this increase in energy, a reduction in mood lability, better mood, and they'll sleep better, and they certainly feel cognitively sharper when they're on a ketogenic diet.
Now, I assume that you're on this diet yourself, and what's been your personal experience? And did you eat very differently initially, and was it a big change in what happened?
Yeah, David, such a great point. So I go in and out of ketosis, and that's what I recommend for everyone. If you're struggling with cognitive decline, I recommend going into ketosis for 3 to 6 months, consistently, wanting to get those ketone levels up, those carb levels, blood sugar down. And what I do, I'm in my 40s and I am looking to prevent cognitive decline as I age. And so I get into ketosis 3 to 4 times a year for 4 to 6 weeks. So I spend part of the time in ketosis, and then I aim to eat mostly a plant-based diet when I'm not in ketosis. Still not non-processed, still very minimal processing, but I'll add in starchy veggies, I'll add in seasonal fruit and other things that will raise my blood sugar. So I go back and forth between those diets, and that's what I recommend to most of my patients. I think that that's a nice happy medium. We all travel. I actually just got back last night from a trip where I was not in ketosis. I was celebrating holidays. I got to go to Japan for the first time, and I had mochi and other yummy treats. Now that I'm back, I'm getting into ketosis. So today was my first day. You saw me eating a little bit of string cheese before we started going here. I've had my tea and my keto snacks and meals today. And what I experience, it takes about 3 days to get into ketosis. So I wouldn't expect myself to be in ketosis right now. It'll be a couple days from now. I will test my blood, make sure that I'm there. And then I'll plan to stay in ketosis for 4 to 6 weeks. And what I expect to feel and what I typically feel is I get up, I wake up around 5 a.m. feeling ready for my day. I'm alert, I am happy, I'm motivated, my mood is good. And when I'm not in ketosis, I'm usually struggling to get out of bed between 6 and 6:30. I'm wanting to hit snooze. I'm not ready for my day in the same way. I also notice I sleep better. I think I get more efficient sleep. I don't wake as much. I wake up feeling much more rested, hence getting up at 5 easily. And I also notice that I'm not hungry. So I don't spend as much time thinking about food throughout the day, planning my meal. I don't need as much. My days are more efficient.
I am not in ketosis, but you make it sound very, very powerful and delightful. Now, you talk about building a brain-nourishing environment for yourself at work and at home. What are the ingredients of that?
You know, one of the simplest things that someone can do to create a brain-nourishing environment is to declutter. So many of us have spaces, you know, it's a desk or a countertop, a dresser drawers that are the top is just cluttered with stuff. You know, there's the bags of things that need to be returned to Amazon and the, you know, all the mail that's piled up. All of these things essentially act like a to-do list coming at our brain whenever we see them visually. And if we can declutter, if we can get some of the stuff out of the way and create a more zen-like experience, then our body and our brains can get into more of a rest, digest, and heal state. It makes us feel less overwhelmed so that then we can use that extra bandwidth to read a book, get some exercise, to engage with a loved one, maybe engage in some creative activity or pursuit, music or art or something that we enjoy. And that extra bandwidth, it can basically be put to work to help and support our brain rather than being this drain, this kind of subconscious drain of energy that makes us feel like we constantly have more to do.
Some people come sort of pre-programmed or something to be one way or the other. For example, I think when I was in college, I almost decided to be a neatnik, you know, and to try to have everything. I think it was a way to try to control my anxiety being away from home for the first time and so on. And then my wife loves to have the house feel lived in, is how she puts it. And there's stuff on top of things everywhere. It's hard to find a chair that you can sit in sometimes because there's a purse in it and there's all kinds of other stuff. Now she's a brilliant woman. It's just her style, and it doesn't seem to cognitively be a problem for her. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think for someone who's struggling cognitively, the clutter can add to confusion. And so that's a time to maybe prioritize it. It sounds like, yes, we each have different personalities and ways we live in the world, and the chaos for her might be something she thrives in. Not everyone is like that. And I think if you're someone who, if you, if, when I say that, when I say declutter, if you go, oh, wow, yeah. I get that sense of overwhelm and kind of that low-grade irritation of always looking at a cluttered surface. If that makes sense for you, if that resonates for you, I encourage you to prioritize that this weekend. Clear off that space and see what it feels like. See how you feel. And if it feels better, then I encourage you to take the time to maintain that. Now, in the case of your wife, that might not be the thing for her. And in the book, I describe a lot of different ways that you can create a brain-nourishing environment. We talk about reducing the toxicity in the environment, taking out any artificial air fresheners, making sure that the smells and scents in your home are only coming from the kitchen or from natural sources, like maybe flowers or essential oils. The chemical toxins they go through our olfactory nerve and directly into our brain and can be highly inflammatory. So we want to make sure we reduce those toxins. Things like plastic in the kitchen, plastic cookware, nonstick cookware, plastic food storage containers, those things can leach into our food, even plastic water bottles. Getting rid of toxins like that, even going in the direction of an organic diet so that we're not exposed to glyphosate and the other pesticides and herbicides that are so common in foods, that can make a difference in terms of how our environment impacts us. Opening doors and windows for an hour a day to let fresh air in. Indoor air is the lowest quality air because it's concentrated. All of our furniture is off-gassing, and our carpets and paints and all these things is putting this. Even my daughter, I have organic mattresses for her. She's got bunk beds, but the bunk bed itself. Here we are, 7 months after we built it and put it in her room, and we got home from this trip, and her room had been closed up, and I could smell the off-gassing of the furniture months and months and months later. So, of course, I opened the windows and had her sleep in a different room last night because I don't want her, she's five, I don't want her brain exposed to those things. And so, thinking through if you get new furniture, having it off-gas, opening doors and windows, taking your shoes off at the door so that you're not tracking in the pesticides and herbicides that are on sidewalks and the petrochemicals that are in parking lots, leave that stuff outside. And it's just a simple habit of opening doors and windows, weather permitting, of course, and leaving your shoes at the door. It's free and simple, easy way to reduce the toxic burden inside your home.
Yeah, thanks to my self-same wife that I mentioned before, we do a lot of those things. We're sensitive to a lot of those issues, and one that really gets me and gets us are so-called air fresheners. And what is an air freshener but some kind of chemical that deadens your nose, so that you can't smell the bad smells, right?
Oh, it's terrible. Yeah, just open doors and windows. Get
Yeah.
fresh air in. I had a teacher say the solution to pollution is dilution.
Wow. You also advocate establishing a morning routine that can then kind of set the cadence for the day.
Yeah, you asked about my personal experience with diet, which has been profoundly helpful for me getting in and out of ketosis. But I really emphasize this morning routine because of my personal experience. I get up and I have a cup of matcha. I do a keto a creamer powder in it with a little bit of almond milk. And I take the time to enjoy my tea and then do a 20-minute meditation. And if something I mentioned, I have a 5-year-old, if she gets up early or if I've got to run out the door to do something else, it feels like my day never really starts. I am not as present. I'm not as creative. I'm not as patient. I am a different person on the days that I skip that. I also noticed about 6 months into meditating every day that even if I didn't have like a great meditation, if I didn't have these profound insights, my mood had shifted. My cognitive capacity had shifted. So many things had improved from a daily meditation practice. And we see this at Marama, the residential care facility for the elderly that I created. We have our residents there meditate every day. And you see that after a couple of months, the patient, our residents there, we're doing the diet, there's social interaction, and there's meditation every day, and there's exercise every day. We're doing a lot of things, but you really see the shift in the room and the shift in attitude, I think, and peace, the sense of everything's okay after everyone's gone through meditation or a prayer practice. And it's infectious, right? It has this spiral. We have our caregivers also do the meditation with the residents because everyone is affected in a beneficial way when we take the time to just sit.
Yeah. I want to come back to some of what you're saying. But one of the things that kind of struck me as funny is what you call dual task training to combine mm-hmm. physical and cognitive exercises. And, you know, we've been hearing lately that multitasking is bad for us and that, in fact, it's not really possible. So that seemed to go against that current popular wisdom.
Yeah. Oh, I love that you drew that connection there. I hadn't even thought of that before. That's great. So multitasking, I think of at this very distracted state, right? Where we're typing an email and we're listening to somebody else and we're maybe taking a sip of coffee and we're doing multiple things at once, or we're driving and we're eating and we're putting on our makeup and we're talking to somebody on the phone all at the same time. And we're not doing any one of them well, right? And that I am not an advocate of. That can actually, I think people have this experience of, oh, I can't remember that person's name, or I don't remember what that person said. And sometimes it's because we were just distracted, because we had too much on our mind, too much we were trying to do at the same time. And that is actually negative for cognition. It adds to that stress and overwhelm. Now, dual task exercising is something entirely different. We're doing two things at the same time, which you're absolutely right. This kind of can sound like multitasking. But what we're doing is we're exercising. We're physically getting our heart rate up. We're physically moving. We're doing strength training or aerobic training. And at the same time, we're engaging cognitively. Now, this might look like ballroom dancing, right? This has been connected to better cognitive outcomes for a long time. And what we're doing there is multitasking, right? We are socially engaged. We are physically engaged with movement. We are engaged. We're listening to the music. We know where we are kinesthetically in time and space because we have to do that in order to match our partner. These things are fantastic for our brain. Now, other examples might be a yoga or Pilates or a Zumba class where we're listening to the cues of an instructor and we have to stay engaged cognitively while we're engaged physically. Walking and talking is the simplest example of a dual task exercise. And then these can get more and more complex and they can be more and more targeted for the individual. But there's great research that comes out of the Pacific Neuroscience Institute, who we've partnered with, that shows that combining physical and cognitive exercise together improves cognitive outcomes.
Yeah. Well, pardon me. I am impressed by your level of output, I have to say. You mentioned a program. You've got two different programs going. You've got a residential treatment thing, which I think you referred to. The name of that again is?
Marama.
Marama. And you have what's the other one? You have another one. What is it?
Yeah. So essentially what happened was after I was trained by Dr. Bredesen, I started developing a reputation for being able to help people with dementia, for them seeing good outcomes. And through that came questions, right, from daughters and loved ones of those suffering with dementia. And they made a lot of sense to me. So at first, we didn't know how likely is it if I bring my loved one to you in a clinical setting at Solseri is the name of my clinic here in San Diego. If we bring our dad in to see you, how likely is it that he will get better? And I didn't know the answer to that question. None of us did in 2017. And since then, I have had the opportunity to do a research trial at my clinic in San Diego, where we took 23 participants through a six-month intervention, intensive intervention, and 17 of the 23 improved. So 74% improved. And we had statistically significant improvements in overall composite cognition, in memory, and in MoCA scores. And we saw improvements in everything that we measured. So verbal ability, concentration, focus, sleep, and quality of life scores. So this was a great way to be able to answer that question. Okay, what is the likelihood that my dad will get better, my mom will get better, my spouse will get better? It's about 75% if your MoCA score, that Montreal Cognitive Assessment, is between 12 and 23. So we can say that now with confidence. Dr. Bredesen and his team did a very similar study. They took 25 participants through a 9-month intervention. And if your MoCA score is over 19, So a little bit better than our patients were more cognitively declined. They had more disease progression. So if you're 19 and above with a 9-month intervention, you have 84% chance of getting better. So this is a fantastic way to answer that question, which I think is a very good one from the loved ones of those with dementia. The other question that we kept getting was, where can I send my loved one? Because this sounds great, but it also sounds like a full-time job. And I've already got one of those. And I've got kids and I've got a household to manage.
Right.
So where can I send my uncle or my aunt or my dad or my mom so that they can get the benefit of Dr. Bredesen's approach? And what happened was I heard that question often enough, and I looked around, and there was nowhere that I could really recommend that was doing a fully immersive experience. And so I thought, how hard can it be to create one? And so that's what we did here in San Diego. And we've partnered with another facility in Kansas, in Wichita, Kansas. So we now have two facilities where we offer an immersive experience of the Bredesen approach, the organic ketogenic diet, the brain-engaging activities, exercise, the social engagement, and a non-toxic environment, plus all of the medication management, so that you can be assured that your loved one is getting the optimal experience and basically has the best chance of improving.
So there's the live-in experience, but is there another one where people come to your clinic? Do they stay in a local motel or something like that and then come every day?
Yeah, so we have the clinical setting. What we do is, if someone's coming from far away, they'll just come for 3 or 4 days. We'll get all the testing done. They'll establish care with the doctor, and then we'll help them create a treatment plan that's specific to the reasons why they have cognitive decline. And then they can do that from the comfort of their home. And we do offer online coaching courses to help them to basically implement what we do at Marama in the comfort of their own home. That's now one of the comments that we get, right? Is, I would love for my mom or dad or spouse to get the benefit of everything that you're doing at Marama, but I don't want them to leave. I want them with me, which I think, my ultimate goal, if I had to pick a professional goal for this lifetime, it would be to make places memory care obsolete, that we wouldn't have to have people develop dementia, that they would be able to stay home in the fabric of their communities or surrounded by loved ones, contributing to the next generation in terms of sharing their wisdom and experience with them directly. And they wouldn't be,
Sure.
siloed in these memory care facilities. So I love doing the coaching work because it helps people get the support they need at home.
Yeah. Well, color me very impressed, and so much energy it must take. And this is probably coming from some kind of semi-conscious bias, but isn't this an extraordinary thing for a naturopath to pull off?
It's so interesting. I appreciate that perspective. I don't I feel very guided to do this work. I feel like I've been given so many opportunities, and the naturopathic foundation, I don't think I would have seen the opportunities. I wouldn't have seen the power of this work if I didn't have that foundational training as a naturopath, right? We are oriented, we started this conversation, we're oriented towards lifestyle medicine, towards, what can we do to support the cell and the natural healing process? How can I be a teacher to my patients and teach them about what will create health in their body? How can I identify root causes? And Dr. Bredesen, although he was trained at Caltech and UCSF and Duke, and he is a his pedigree is incredibly impressive, and he's a medical doctor. And he basically kind of came full circle and was teaching me as a naturopath. He was showing me that I could apply naturopathic medicine to the brain and get better outcomes than any of the pharmaceuticals available on the market.
How do you spell his name?
Bredesen is B-R-E, well, Dale is his first name, Dale. Bredesen is Bredesen.
Bredesen.
Bredesen, yeah. And
Okay, okay.
he wrote the book The End of Alzheimer's.
Okay. Wow. Well, is there anything that we haven't said here that we should say before I let you go?
Well, there was one piece that my OCD is bothering me about. I suggested that there were 4 steps to proper digestion, and we only got to talk about 3. So I did want to just circle back to that.
Okay.
I think this last one is really important. So first, we talked about choosing the right things to eat. So what you put in your mouth, that becomes what your cells are made of. That's the building blocks. Then the second is that ability to digest, to break it down into pieces that you can then third assimilate, that you can then bring into your body, into your bloodstream, and then create your cells, create those neurotransmitters that are going to help us maintain mood and cognition. The fourth step might be the most important. That's the ability to eliminate what doesn't serve us. So having that regular daily bowel movement. And I mentioned that, you could apply these concepts to media, to relationships, to many other things in our lives. So what is going to serve you? What are you putting in? Does it serve you? Is it things that are going to nourish you? Can you break it down into pieces that you can then absorb and assimilate? And can you let go of what does not serve you? And when you can do all four of those pieces, when there's not a backup anywhere, then I think that we have a better chance of achieving health.
Well, I'm glad you got to get all of that in. And Dr. Heather Sandison, I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's such a privilege, David. Thank you for having me.
I come away from the interview with Dr. Heather Sandison tremendously impressed by her energy and her expertise. I've interviewed other naturopathic doctors in the past, but I believe she stands out as pretty unique. Unfortunately, I am in an age group where I have friends who are suffering from dementia and/or have been diagnosed with Alzheimer's specifically. I'm going to contact their spouses and suggest that they listen together to this interview because I think that information shared here may have particular relevance for them. I know that I learned some things that I didn't know before. For example, her assertion that there are blood tests now that can definitively diagnose Alzheimer's is news to me. I hope that, in fact, that is the case. I probably will need to follow up on my own to ascertain the factuality of that assertion. As you will have heard, I'm especially impressed by the treatment programs and facilities that she set up. I'm happy to have had the opportunity to share her work with you, and I wish her good fortune in continuing her pioneering efforts.
Hi, Dr. Dev. This is me, Dr. Ahmed Al-Aghouri, a psychiatrist from Alexandria, Egypt. I'm a follower and listener for your blog and radio more than 5 years. I got great benefit from the episode, which approach sometimes is practical, pragmatic, and down to the earth, and sometimes philosophical and theoretical. I love both approaches. I love your guests from all the mental health professionals. Also, I love your insight about the union approach. It has jerked me to be interested in the union approach. Thank you, Dr. Dev.
Thank you, Ahmed, there in Alexandria, Egypt. It's especially good to hear from a listener in your part of the world, and I'm so glad to learn that this series has opened you up to an appreciation of the Jungian approach. It definitely made me feel good as well. Also, thank you for encouraging others to follow your fine example. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks to naturopathic doctor Heather Sandison for sharing her encouraging successes with people suffering from dementia and even Alzheimer's. Next week, my guest will be osteopathic doctor James Champion, who has written a novel in which the hero faces the trials and tribulations and triumphs of attending medical school. In our interview, we'll be discussing not only his novel, but his own actual experiences in getting through medical school. I hope you will join us then. And until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.